Book 6. To One in Chains. If you knew where this path led, would you have walked it? If you knew the pain at love's solemn end, would you have awakened it? In darkness the wheel turns, in darkness the dust dims, in red fire the wheel burns, in darkness the sun spins. If you knew the thought in your head, would you have spoken it? If by this one word you betrayed a friend, would you have uttered it? In darkness the wheel turns, in darkness the dust dims, in red fire the wheel burns, in darkness the sun spins. If you knew the face of the dead, would you have touched it? If by this coin a soul's journey to send, would you have stolen it? In darkness the wheel turns, in darkness the dust dims, in red fire the wheel burns, in darkness the sun spins. Sparak Chant, Psalm 7, The Vulture's Laugh, the Sparak Nethem. Chapter 17. The faces all in rows will wait as I take each in my hands, remembering what it is to be who I am not. Will all these struggles fade into white, or melt like snow on stone in the heat of dawn? Do you feel my hands? These weathered wings of dreams of flight, stripped, are gifts worn down. Still I hold fast and climb sure through your eyes. Who waits for me away from the ravaged nests? The scenes of violence, any searching will easily find the broken twigs, the tufts of feather and hair, the spilled now drying. Did you spring a light swift away unharmed? So many lies we leave be, the sweet feeding to make us strong, but the rows are unmoving, and we journey without a step. What I dare you to lose, I surrendered long ago. But what I beg you to find, must I then lose? In these rows there are tales for every line, every broken smile. Draw close then, and dry these tears, for I have a story to tell. The Unwitnessed, Fisher Keltath.
These soldiers.
The two words hung in her mind like meat from butcher hooks. They twisted slowly, aimlessly. They dripped, but the drips had begun to slow. Lying on her side atop the packs of wrapped food, Badal could let her head sink down on one side and see the rough trail stretching away behind them. Not much was being left behind now, barring the bodies, and beneath the light of the jade strangers those pale shapes looked like toppled statues of marble lining a long-abandoned road. Things with their stories gone, their histories forever lost. When she tired of that view, she could set her gaze the opposite way, looking ahead, and from her vantage point the column was like a swollen worm with thousands of heads upon its elongated back, each one of them slave to the same crawling body. Every now and then the worm cast off a part of it that had died, and these pieces were pushed out to the sides. Hands would reach down from those walking past, collecting up fragments of clothing which would be used during the day, stitched together to make flies, gifts of shade from the dead, and by the time those discarded pieces came close to her, why, they'd be mostly naked, and they'd have become marble statues.
Because when things fail, you topple the statues.
Directly before her, the bared backs of the haulers glistened with precious sweat as they strained in their yokes, and the thick ropes twisted as they went taut and gusted out breaths of glittering dust all down their length.
They call these soldiers heavies, some of them anyway, the ones who don't stop, who don't fall down, who don't die, the ones who scare the others and make them keep going until they fall over dead. Heavies. These soldiers?
She thought back. The sun had been spilling out along the horizon. The day was going away, and it had been a day when no one had spoken, when the snake had been silent. She had been walking 3 paces behind Rut, and Rut walked hunched over around Held, who was huddled in his arms, and Held's eyes were closed against the glare. But then they were always closed, because so much in the world was too hard to look at. This would be their last night. They knew it. The whole snake knew it. Badal had said nothing to change their minds. Perhaps she too had given up. It was hard to know for certain. Defiance could hold its shape, even when it was made of nothing but cinders and ash. Anger could look hot to the touch, when in truth it was lifeless and cold. In this way the world could deceive. It could lie, and in lying it invited delusion. It invited the idea that what it was true. In this way the world could make belief a fatal illness. She stared down at the backs of the heavies and remembered more. Rut's steps wavered, halted, his voice cracked as it made a wordless sound, and then it cracked a second time, and he said, "Badal, the flies are walking now." She looked down at her legs to see if they could take her up alongside him, and slowly, agonizingly, they did, and far ahead, to the place where he was looking with his blinded, closed-up eyes, she saw swarming shapes, black as they came out of the sunset's red glare, black and seething, flies walking on 2 legs, one clump, then another and another, emerging from the bloodlight.
"The flies," said Rut, "are walking."
But she had sent them away, her last command of power, the one that used her up, and now, this day, she had been blowing nothing but air from her lips. Badal squinted.
"I want to be blind again, Badal."
She studied the puffed masses filling his sockets.
"You still are, Rut. Then they are in my head. The flies in my head. No, I see them too. But that seething, it is just the sun's light behind them. Rut, they are people."
He almost fell then, but widened his stance, and with terrible grace he straightened.
"Fathers! No, yes, no. Did we turn round, Badal? Did we somehow turn round? No, see the west. We have walked into the sun every day, every dusk."
She was silent then. The snake was coiling up behind the two of them, its scrawny body of bones drawing together, as if that could keep it safe. The figures from the sunset were coming closer.
"Rut! There are children. What is that upon their skin, their faces?"
She saw the one father among them, his beard grey and rust, his eyes suffering the way the eyes of some fathers did as they sent their young ones away for the last time. But the faces of the children drew her attention.
"Tattoos. They have marked themselves, Rut. Droplets, black tears. No, I see the truth of it now. Not tears. The tears have dried up and will never return. These marks upon face and hands, arms and neck, shoulders and chest. These marks. Rut! Badal! They have claws."
A ragged breath fell out from him, left him visibly trembling.
"Try now, Rut. Your eyes. Try to open them." I can't. Try. You must."
The father, along with his mob of clawed children, drew closer. They were wary, she could see that.
"They did not expect us. They did not come looking for us. They are not here to save us."
She could see their suffering now, the thirst that gripped their faces like taloned skeletal hands.
"Claws will make you suffer."
Yet the father, now standing before Rut, reached down to the waterskin strapped to his sword belt. There was little water in it. That was obvious by its thinness, the ease with which he lifted it. Tugging the stopper free, he held it out to Rut, who in turn thrust out Held.
"Her first," he said. "Please, the little one first."
The gesture was unambiguous, and without hesitation the father stepped up. and as Rut pulled the cloth from in front of Held's small, wizened face, the bearded man leaned close. She saw him recoil, saw him look up and stare hard into Rut's slitted eyes. Badal held her breath, waited. Then he shifted the waterskin, dipped the mouthpiece over Held's mouth, and the water trickled down. She sighed.
"This father, Rut, is a good father."
One of the clawed children, a year or two older than Rut, came up then and gently took Held from Rut's arms. He might have resisted, but did not have the strength, and when the babe was in the cradle of the strange boy's arms, Rut's own arms remained crooked, as if he still held her, and Badal saw how the tendons at his elbows had shrunk, drawn tight. And she thought back, trying to recall when she had last seen Rut not holding Held, and she couldn't. The baby was a ghost in his arms now. The father was weeping. She could see the tracks down his darkened, pitted cheeks, and he guided the mouthpiece into Rut's mouth, forcing it past the boy's lips, a few drops, and then out again. Rut swallowed. The other children, with claws, slipped past them, into the coiled snake, each pulling out their own waterskins. But there were not enough of them. Still they went. And now Badal saw a new snake coming out of the sunset, and this one was of iron and chains, and she knew that she had seen it before, in her dreams. She had looked down upon this glittering serpent.
"Fathers and mothers, but children all. And there, I see her. That is their one mother. I see her. She comes."
People spilled out around the woman with more waterskins. She halted close to the bearded father, her eyes on Badal. And when she spoke, it was in the language of Badal's dreams.
"Fiddler, they are walking the wrong way."
"Aye, adjunct."
"I see only children."
"Aye."
Standing behind this woman was another soldier.
"But, adjunct, who do they belong to?"
She turned.
"It doesn't matter, Fist, because they now belong to us."
Rut turned to Badal.
"What are they saying?" "They're saying we have to go back."
The boy mouthed the last word.
"Back?"
Badal said.
"Rut, you did not fail. You guided the snake, and your blind tongue flicked out and found these strangers, who are strangers no longer. Rut, you led us from death and into life. Rut,"
she stepped close,
"you can rest now."
The bearded man, whose name was Fiddler, managed to break Rut's fall, but both went down to their knees. The adjunct took a half step.
"Captain, does he live?"
He looked up after a moment.
"If his heart still beats, adjunct, I can neither feel nor hear it."
Badal spoke in their language.
"He lives, father. He has just gone away, for a time."
The man mother had called Fist, who had been standing back, now edged forward and said,
"Child, how is it you speak Malazan? Who are you?"
"Who am I? I don't know. I've never known."
She met mother's eyes.
"Rut led us to you, because you are the only ones left."
"Only ones?"
"The only ones who will not turn away from us. You are our mother."
At that, the adjunct seemed to step back, her eyes flaring as if struck to pain. And then she looked away from Badal, who then pointed at Fiddler.
"And he is our father, and soon he will go away and we will never see him again. It is the way of fathers."
That thought made her sad, but she shook her head against the feeling.
"It is just the way."
The adjunct seemed to be trembling and unable to look upon Badal. Instead, she turned to the man beside her.
"Fist, broach the reserve casks."
"Adjunct, look at them. Half will die before dawn."
"Fist Blistig, I have given you an order."
"We cannot spare any water. Not for these.
"Obey my command,"
said the adjunct in a weary tone, "or I will have you executed here immediately."
"And face open rebellion, I swear it."
Fiddler had straightened, and now he walked to stand in front of Fist Blistig, so close that the fist took a step back. He said nothing, only smiled, his teeth white amidst that tangle of rusty beard. Snarling an oath, Blistig swung round.
On your heads, then!
The adjunct spoke.
Captain Zeal and Gud, accompany Fist Blistig.
A man and a woman who had been hanging back swung round to flank Blistig as he marched back into the column. Fiddler returned to where Rutt was lying. He knelt beside the boy, settled one hand to one side of the thin face. Then he looked up at Badal.
He led you?
She nodded. How far? How long? She shrugged.
Collants.
The man blinked, looked over at the adjunct for an instant, and then back to Badal.
How many days, then, to water?
She shook her head.
To Icarius, where there are wells. I can't remember. 7 days? 10?
Impossible, said someone from the crowd gathered behind the adjunct. We have a day's supply left. Without water, 3 days at the most. Adjunct, we cannot make it.
Badal cocked her head.
Where there is no water, there is blood. Flies, shards. Where there is no food, there are children who have died.
Someone said,
Fist Blistig is right this time, adjunct. We can't do this.
Captain Fiddler.
Aye.
Have your scouts guide the ones who can walk back to the food wagons. Ask the Cundrill to attend to those who cannot. See to it that everyone gets water and food if they can manage any.
Aye, adjunct.
Badal watched him ease his arms under Rutt, watched him lift the boy.
Rutt is now held. He carried held until he could carry her no longer, and now he is carried, and this is how it goes on. Adjunct,
she said as Fiddler carried Rutt away,
I am named Badal, and for you I have a poem.
Child, if you stand there unattended to for much longer, you are going to die. I will hear your poem, but not now.
Badal smiled.
Yes, mother. And for you, I have a poem.
She stared at the straining backs, the shedding ropes, the toppled statues by the wayside. 2 nights now since that meeting, since the last time Badal had seen the adjunct, or the man named Fiddler. And the water was now gone, and still Rutt would not wake. And Sadik sat atop the bales, putting his things in patterns, only to pack them away again, until the next time. And she listened to the arguments. She heard the fighting, saw the sudden roiling eddies where fists lashed out, soldiers grappled, knives were drawn. She watched as these men and women stumbled towards death, because Icarius was too far away. They had nothing left to drink. And now those who drank their own piss were starting to go mad because piss was poison. But they would not bleed out the dead ones. They just left them to lie on the ground. This night she had counted 54. The night before there had been 39. And on the day in between they'd carried 72 bodies from the camp, not bothering to dig a trench this time, simply leaving them lying in rows. The children of the snake were on the food wagons. Their walking was done, and they too were dying.
Icarius, I see your wells. They were almost dry when we left you. Something is taking the water away even now. I don't know why, but it doesn't matter. We will not reach them. Is it true, then, that all mothers must fail, and all fathers must walk away never to be seen again? Mother, for you I have a poem. Will you come to me? Will you hear my words?
The wagon rocked, the heavies strained, soldiers died. They were on a path now. Fiddler's scouts had little trouble following it. Small, bleached bones, all the ones who had fallen behind the boy named Rutt, the girl named Badal. Each modest collection he stumbled over was an accusation, a mute rebuke. These children, they had done the impossible, and now we fail them. He could hear the blood in his own veins, frantic, rushing through hollow places, and the sound it made was an incessant howl. Did the adjunct still believe? Now that they were dying by the score, did she still hold to her faith? When determination, when stubborn will proved not enough, what then? He had no answers to such questions. If he sought her out, no, she's had enough of that. They're on her constantly. Fists, captains, the cutters. Besides, talking was torture. Lips split open, the swollen tongue struggled. The back of the throat, tight and cracked, was pained by every uttered word. He walked with his scouts, not wanting to drop back, to see what was happening in the column. Not wanting to witness its disintegration. Were his heavies still pulling the wagons? If they were, they were fools. Were any of those starved children left? That boy, Rutt, who'd carried that thing for so long his arms looked permanently crippled. Was he still in a coma, or had he slipped away, believing he'd saved them all? That would be the best, to ride the delusion into oblivion. There are no ghosts here, not in this desert. His soul just drifted away, simple, peaceful, rising, carrying that baby, because he will always carry that baby. Go well, lad. Go well, the both of you. They'd come looking for a mother and a father, 1,000 children, 1,000 orphans. But he was beginning to see, here on this trail, just how many more there had once been. In this train Badal had called the snake, and the comprehension of that twisted like a knife in his chest. Kalance, what have you done? To your people, to your children? Kalance, had you no better answer than this? Gods, if we could have found you, if we could have faced you across a killing field, we would give answer to your crimes. Adjunct, you were right to seek this war. But you were wrong thinking we could win it. You cannot wage war against indifference. Ah, listen to me. But am I dead? Not yet. The previous day, when the entire camp was silent, soldiers lying motionless beneath the flies, he had reached into his pack, settled his hand upon the deck of dragons, and nothing, lifeless. This desert was bereft, and no power could reach them. We have made the gods blind to us, the gods and the enemy ahead. Adjunct, I see your reason for this. I did then, and I do now. But look at us. We're human, mortal, no stronger than anyone else. And for all that you wanted to make us something more, something greater, it seems that we cannot be what you want. We cannot be what we want, either. And this, more than anything else, is what now crushes us. But still, I am not yet dead. He thought back to the moment when they'd found the children. The way his scouts, not much older themselves, moved so solemnly among the refugees, giving all the water they carried, their entire allotment for the night's march given away, from one mouth to the next, until the last drops had been squeezed from the skins. And then the Kundril youths could only stand helpless, each surrounded by children who reached out, not to grasp or demand, but to touch, and in that touch give thanks. Not for the water, that was gone, but for the gesture. How far must one fall to give thanks for nothing but desire, empty intent? The ones who drove you away. But we have allies, and there is no barrier before them. Nothing to slow their march on Kalance. Gessler, show Stormy the truth of this, and then cut his leash. Leave him to voice a howl to make the hounds themselves cower. Let him loose, Guess, I beg you, because I don't think we can make it. The bones of his neck grinding, Fiddler looked up, glad at the jade strangers. They filled the night sky now, blazing slashes across heaven's face. Omens make me puke. I'm sick of the miserable things. But what if you're nothing like that, you up there? What if your journey belongs to you and you alone? No destination, no reason or purpose. What if tomorrow or the next day you finally descend to wipe out all of us, to make pointless our every struggle, our every great noble cause? What is it then, O glorious universe, that you are telling us? Destiny is a lie. But then, do I even care?
Look at these bones we step over. We go as far as we can go, and then we stop. And that is how it is. That is all it is. So, now what?
Snakes, said Banaskar, blinking against the hard clarity of sober vision. It was better when everything was blurred, much better. That might have been my first fear, the one that had me stumbling right into the pit of vipers we so blithely call the Temple of the Wreck. Face what you fear, isn't that the sage advice? Maybe that's sobriety's real curse, the recognition that being frightened is not character building after all, and that the advice was shit and the world is full of liars.
The adjunct was silent as she walked beside him. Not that he was expecting a reply, since he was no longer certain that his words were actually getting past his throat. It was possible, indeed highly likely, that everything he'd been saying for the past 2 days had been entirely in his own mind. But then it was easier that way.
Rebellion. Even the word itself makes me envious. I've never felt it here in my soul. Never experienced a single moment of defiant fury, of the self demanding its right to be just the way it wants to be. Even when it doesn't know what that being looks like, it just wants it. Of course, drinking is the sweet surrender, the sanctum of cowards. And we're all cowards, us drunks, and don't let anyone try to convince you otherwise. It's the only thing we're good at, mostly, because it's both our reason and the means by which we run away from everything, which is why a drunk needs to stay drunk.
He glanced across at her. Was she listening? Was there anything to listen to?
Let's move on. That subject makes me cringe. Another grand notion awaits us as soon as I can think of one. Snakes, you ask? Well, of course it was a grand notion, the girl giving us names like that. Theirs, ours. Snakes in the desert. It's bold, if you think about it. Snakes are damned hard to kill. They slide past underfoot. They hide in plain sight. So, how about knowledge? When knowing becomes a fall from grace. When truth is seen to condemn rather than liberate. When enlightenment shows nothing but the dark pathos of our endless list of failures. All that. But these attitudes, well, they come from those who want to encourage ignorance, a vital tactic in their maintenance of power. Besides, real knowledge forces one to act. Or does it?
He paused then, trying to think it through, only to feel a spasm of fear.
You're right, let's move on yet again. If there's one thing I know, it's that about some things I don't want to know anything. So, in keeping with unexpected guests, shall we speak of heroism?
Smiles staggered to one side and dropped to one knee. Bottle took up position behind her, guarding her back. The short sword in his hand seemed to be trembling all on its own. He watched Tar bull his way back through the milling press. His visage was darker than Bottle had ever seen before.
Coric, he snapped. Yes, Sergeant. You live? Got a look in an eye, the man replied, edging into view.
One side of his face was sheathed in blood, but it wasn't his own.
Seen hyenas looking saner.
He pointed with a bloodied long knife.
That corporal there gave him a nudge.
The man Coric indicated was on his knees, a regular, burly, broad-shouldered, with a knife handle jutting from the right side of his chest. Blood was streaming from his mouth and nostrils, filled with bubbles. Tar glared round, his eyes catching Bottle. He walked over.
Smiles, look at me, soldier.
She lifted her head.
Like Coric said, Sergeant, we ain't blind and we ain't stupid. Caught the same nudge. So I gave him my knife.
Tar met Bottle's eyes. Bottle nodded.
12 paces between them in the dark, in a crowd. The dying corporal had dropped his bearded chin to his chest and seemed to be staring at his knees. Korab edged closer and gave the man a push. He fell over. The thudding impact, as he landed on the ground, spurted one last mass of foam from his mouth and nose. "Two down?" Tar asked. Bottle could feel the hatred in the eyes of the regulars crowding the scene, and he flinched when Korab said, "Three, Sergeant. The first two were the distraction. Two more came in low from behind, making for the wagon. I got the first one, then Cuttle chased the last one away. Still after him, I guess."
"He's out there?" Tar demanded. "Hood's breath."
Smiles straightened and, moving drunkenly, made her way to the dead corporal, where she retrieved her knife.
"It ain't right," she muttered.
She faced the crowd.
"We're guarding empty casks, you damned fools!"
Someone called out.
"Wasn't us, Marine! That was the Fist's gang!"
Bottle scowled.
"Blistig, guards below." "Just leave us alone," Smiles said, turning away.
Cuttle returned, caught Tar's eye, and with one hand casually brushed the crossbow slung down behind his left arm. The sergeant faced the haulers.
"Pull up the rope, soldiers. Let's get this moving again."
Smiles came up to Bottle.
"Killing our own. It ain't right."
"I know."
"You had my back. Thanks."
He nodded. The crowd of regulars was melting away. The wagon started rolling, the squad falling in alongside it, and the bodies were left behind.
"It's the madness," said Korab a short time later. "In 7 cities...
"You don't need to tell us," Cuttle interrupted. "We was there, remember?"
"Aye, just saying, that's all. The madness of thirst."
"That was planned out."
"The corporal, aye," Korab said. "But not that fool going for Korik."
"And the ones coming in from behind?" "Planned, Korab. Someone's orders." "That ain't madness. That ain't anything of the sort."
"Mostly I was talking about the rest of them regulars, the ones closing in on the smell of blood."
No one had any response to that. Bottle found that he was still holding his short sword. Sighing, he sheathed it. Short Nose took the blood-stained shirt and pushed it beneath the collar of the leather yoke, stuffing it across the width of his collarbones where his skin had been worn away and things were looking raw. Someone had brought in the shirt, sopping wet and warm, but all that blood didn't bother him much. He was already adding to it. The wagon was heavy, heavier now with children riding atop all the bundles of food, but for all their numbers, not as heavy as it should have been. That was because they were mostly starved down to bones. He didn't like thinking about that. Back when he'd been a child, he remembered hungry times, but every one of those times his da would come in with something for the runts, Short Nose the runtiest of them all. A scrap, something to chew. And his ma, she'd go out with other ma's, and they'd be busy for a few days and nights, and then she'd come back in, sometimes bruised, sometimes weeping, but she'd have money for the table, and that money turned into food. His da used to swear a lot those times she did that. But it was all down to feeding the runts.
"My beautiful runts," his da liked saying.
And then, years later, when the garrison had up and left town, suddenly Ma couldn't get the money the way she used to. But she and da were happier for all of that anyway. Short Nose's older brothers had all gone off by then, two of them to war, and the other one to marry Widow Karis, who was 10 years older than him and who Short Nose secretly loved with all his might. So it was probably a good thing he ran away when he did, since his brother wouldn't have taken kindly to that trouble behind the barn with Karis drunk, or maybe not, and anyway, it was all in good fun. He noticed a boy walking beside him, carrying a sack. His hands were bloody, and he was licking them clean.
"Brought me that shirt, did you? Ain't good, runt," he said. "Drinking blood."
The boy frowned up at him and went on with his licking until his hands were clean. And he'd heard later how one of his brothers got killed outside Nathilog,
and the other one came back with only one leg. And then the pensions came through, and Ma and Da stopped having to struggle so, especially when Shortnose joined up himself and sent 2/3 of his pay back home. Half of that went home to Da and Ma. The other third went to his brother and his wife, because he felt guilty about the baby and all. Still, it wasn't good being hungry so young, and starving was worst of all. His Da used to say, "If you can't feed them, don't have them. Hood's proud pole, it don't take a genius to see that." It sure don't, and that was why Shortnose kept paying for his runt. And he'd still be paying for it if it wasn't for them being fired and made outlaws and deserters and all the other names the military came up with for not doing what they told you to do. By now, though, that runt would be old enough to work all on its own, so maybe his brother would have called off the bounty on his head. Maybe everything was all right by now, the dust settled and all. It was nice to think so, but now he'd gone and fallen in love with Flash, Wit, and Mayfly, and wasn't that silly, since there were two of them and only one of him? Not that he saw that as a problem, but women could get funny about things like that, and lots of other things too, which was why there was so much trouble. The hauler on his right stumbled. Shortnose reached down one-handed and lifted the woman back onto her feet. She gasped her thanks. Now, women. He could think about women all.
"You're Shortnose, aren't you?"
He glanced down at her. She was short, with big, strong-looking legs. Now that was bad luck for her, wasn't it? The one thing that made proper men drool turned out getting her yoked like a...
"Yeah, that's me."
"In trying to look, you see?"
"No."
"I heard you got the same ear bitten off twice."
"So?"
"Well, how's that possible?"
"Don't ask me. It was all Bread's fault."
"Bread? Nefarious Bread? You were fighting him?"
"Might have been. Save your breath, soldier. See this runt here? He ain't saying a thing, 'cause he's smart."
"It's because he doesn't understand Malazan."
"As good an excuse as any, I always say. Anyway, just keep pulling and think about things you like to think about, to distract you from all the bad stuff."
"What are you thinking about?"
"Me? Women."
"Right," she said in a strangely cold tone. "So I guess I'll think about handsome, clever men."
He smiled down at her.
"You don't have to do that, lass. You got one walking right beside you."
The boy went away and came back a short time later with some more cloth, which he gave to Shortnose so that he could stop his bleeding nose. Like his Da used to say,
"There ain't no figuring the ways of women."
Too bad, too. She was kind of pretty, and even better, she could swear the hide off a Bedouin. Could there be a sexier combination? He didn't think so.
"You'd think I was some kind of leper. It ain't my fault I've been dead once. And maybe being dead once means things like getting thirsty don't hurt as much. I don't know."
"I have been condensing everything in sight," the verdict said. "That's what's been keeping me going."
Hedge eyed the alchemist quizzically, and then he shrugged.
"Beats talking all day, I suppose."
The verdict opened his mouth and then shut it again.
"How are the kittens?"
"The kittens are just fine, Commander."
"We got enough of them?"
"For more than one engagement? Hard to say, sir. I'm comfortable with one battle, using what we need and not holding back."
He glanced back at the carriage and then said,
"I have given some thought to strategies, sir, with respect to alchemical, kittens. I don't think being misers with them works. You want to go the opposite way, in fact. Flood the field of battle, hit them so hard the shock overwhelms them."
"I thought you wasn't going to talk all night." "Listen, we worked that out years ago. Walls and waves, we called it. Walls when you was holding a line or position, waves when you was on the advance. And there ain't no point in holding back, except the one with your own name on it, of course. Because every sapper will tell you, if you're going to kill them, they're going to kill you at the same time, guaranteed. We call it disincentive.
Verdict glanced back a second time, frowned at the troops stumping along beside the carriage. The captains weren't doing well. Thinning out, but not in a good way. They'd not said much in days. Behind them walked the Cundrill, still leading their horses.
So I wasn't quite telling Hedge the truth. I didn't just dose the oxen, but you'd think they'd see.
Still nervous? Hedge asked him. I'd be, if I was you. Cundrill like their horses. A lot. Between a warrior's horse and his mother, it's even odds which one he'd save if it came down to choosing. Then you just went and killed them.
They were dying anyway, sir. In a single day, a horse needs more water than four soldiers, and those Cundrill were running out. Try bleeding a dehydrated animal, sir. It isn't easy.
Right. So now they got undead horses and still no water. Meaning if you'd done that a week ago, why, all that sacrifice wouldn't have been necessary. They want to kill you, alchemist. It took me half a day to talk them out of it.
Verdict glared at Hedge.
You just said, between horses and their mothers...
They'd save their mothers, of course. What are you, an idiot?
The alchemist sighed.
Anyway, Hedge continued after a moment, we're all bridge burners now. Now, it's true we killed a few officers every now and then, if they was bad enough. Who wouldn't? Get a fool in charge and they're likely to get you all killed, so better top 'em first, right? But you ain't done nothing to earn that. Besides, I need you and so do they. So it's simple and all. Nobody's gonna cut your throat.
I am most relieved, Commander.
Hedge moved closer, dropping his voice.
But listen, it's all about to fall apart. Can you see that? The Bone Hunters, those regulars, they're losing it.
Sir, we're not much better off.
So we don't want to get caught up in the slaughter, right? I already told my captains. We're going to pull out hard as soon as it starts up. I want 100 paces between us before they start looking for somebody new to kill.
Sir, do you think it will get that bad?
Hedge shrugged.
Hard to say. So far, the Marines are holding them all in check. But there's going to come a scrap any time now when a Marine gets taken down. And the smell of blood will do it, mark my words.
How would the bridge burners have handled this, sir, back in the day?
Simple. Sniff out the yappers and kill 'em. It's the ones who can't stop bitching, talking it up, egging on the stupider ones to do something stupid, hoping it all busts out. Me.
He nodded to the column walking beside them.
I'd jump Blistig and drag him off into the desert, and for a whole damned day nobody'd be sleeping because of all the screaming.
No wonder you all got outlawed,
Verdict muttered. The sky to the east was lightening, the sun rising to wage war with the jade strangers before they plunged beneath the north horizon. The column broke down in sections, clumps of soldiers spilling away onto the sides of the trail. Sinking down, heads lowered, weapons and armor clashing as packs dropped to the ground. The haulers stopped, struggled out of the heavy yokes, wailing from the Cundrill as yet another horse stumbled and fell onto its side, and out flashed the knives, and this day there would be plenty of blood to drink, but no one rejoiced among the burned tears. Where the wagons halted, the Marines settled, red-eyed and slack-faced with exhaustion. On all sides the soldiers moved like old men and women, fighting to raise tarps and flies, roll out bedding, pausing to rest between tasks. Weapons were slowly drawn, the day's damage repaired with oiled whetstones, but the act was almost mindless, gestures of instinct observed by dull, sullen eyes. And then out from the wagons came the children, in ones and twos, into the midst of the soldiers. They came not to beg or plead, but simply to sit, watching over the soldiers as they slept, or suffered with staring eyes, or, in the case of some, quietly died. Sergeant Sinter observed this as she sat leaning against the wheel of the wagon they'd been guarding. The tremulous arrival of a child into every knot of soldiers seemed to have a strange effect upon them. Arguments fell away, glaring eyes faded, resentments sank down. The sleepless rolled onto their sides and surrendered to weariness. Pain was swallowed back, and those who sat weeping without tears eventually settled into silence. What gift was this? She did not understand, and when a soldier awoke in the closing of dusk and found curled at his or her side a small, still form, cool and pale in the dying light, she'd seen how the squad then gathered to set shards of crystal over the lifeless child, raising a glittering mound. And the soldiers would then cut fetishes free from their belts and harnesses, the bones they'd carried since Arran, and set them upon the pathetic heaps of rock.
"They're killing us."
She looked over at her sister, who sat against the back wheel, her splintered legs stretched out.
"Who is it this time, Kiswear? They come and share the last moments, ours, theirs. It's not fair what they bring."
Sinta's eyes narrowed on Kiswear.
"You've gone away, sister. Will you ever come back?"
"I don't know what they bring," she said.
"You wouldn't."
A dull awakening of anger, which then drained away.
"Why do you say that?"
Kiswear bared her teeth, the back of her head resting between two spokes, her eyes closed.
"What you always had, Sinter, what I never had. That's why you can't see it, can't recognize it. It'd be like seeing into your own soul, and that's something nobody can do. Oh, they say they can. Talk about revelation or truth. All that shit. But inside us, something stays hidden, forever. There's nothing hiding inside me, Kiswear. But those children, sitting, watching, lying close, it hurts you to see them, doesn't it?"
Sinter looked away.
"You fool," Kiswear sighed. "They bring dignity. Same as you, same as the adjunct herself. Why do you think so many of us hate her, hate the sight of her? She shows us everything we don't want to be reminded of, because there's nothing harder for most of us to find than dignity. Nothing. So they show us how you can die with dignity. They show us by dying themselves, and by letting us die while being watched over." The adjunct said unwitnessed. "These children don't agree. But it's all pointless anyway."
Kiswear went on.
"Did you think this would be easy? Did you think our feet wouldn't start to drag? We've walked across half a world to get here. We stopped being an army long ago. And no, I don't know what we are now. I don't think there's a person in this world who'd be able to give us a name."
"We're not going to make it," Sinter said.
"So what?"
Sinter looked across at her sister. Their eyes briefly locked. Just past Kiswear, Corporal Rim sat hunched over, rubbing oil into the stump of his right arm. He made no sign of listening, but she knew he was. Same for Honey, lying shrouded under stained linen to keep the sun from her eyes.
"So you don't care, Kiswear. You never did. Surviving this ain't the point, Sinter. It stopped being the point some time ago."
"Right," she snapped. "So enlighten me."
"You already know. You said it yourself. We're not going to make it. And those children, they come among us like homunculi, made up of everything we surrendered in our lives. All that dignity and integrity and truth, all of it. And look at them, starved down to bones and not much else. We ain't been too good with the best in us, sister, have we?"
If tears had been possible, Sinter would have wept them. Instead, she sank down onto the hard ground.
"You should have run," she said. "I bet the adjunct says that to herself 1,000 times a day. "The adjunct?"
Sinter shook her head.
"She's not the running type." "No, and neither are you. And now, it turns out, neither am I. This is not my sister." "I think," Kiswear resumed, "tomorrow will be our last march. And you know, it's all right. It was worth the try. Someone should tell her that,
it was worth the try.
No spiders, said Helion, settling her head back on the bedroll. This is the best there is. This desert, it's paradise. Let the flies and Cape Moss take my corpse. Even those damned meat-eating locusts. You won't find a spider making a nest in my skull's eye sockets. What could be better than that?
What got you so scared of 'em, Sergeant?
She thought about that, but then her mind wandered away, and she saw heaps of skulls, all of them smiling. And why not? Oh yes, no spiders.
My father tells the story, especially when he's drunk. He thinks it's damned funny, that story. Oh, wait, is that my father? Could be my uncle, or even my stepfather. Might even be my brother's father, who lives down the lane. Anyway, it was a story, and how he laughed. You got to know Kartul, maybe. Spiders big enough to eat gulls, right?
Been there once, aye, Sergeant. Creepy place.
The redbacks are the worst. Not big. Not much poisonous by themselves. One at a time, I mean. Thing is, when they hatch, there's thousands, and they stick together for days, so they can kill big prey and all of them feed on it, right? And the egg sacs, why, they can be hidden anywhere. So, I was maybe two, spent all day in a crib every day, since my mother had another baby on the way, only she kept getting fevers, and eventually she went and lost it, which was stupid, since we had a good healer down the street. But father drank up all the coin he made. Anyway, I had this doll.
Oh, God, Sergeant.
Aye, they came out of its head. Ate right through the stuffing and then out through the eyes and the mouth and everywhere else. And there I was, food. It was my half-brother who came in and found me. My head was swollen to twice its size. Couldn't even see my eyes. And I was choking. Counted 200 bites, maybe more, since they were mostly in my hair. Now, as far as prey goes, I was too big even for 1,000 redback babies. But they tried damned hard.
And that story made him laugh? What kind of fucked up...
Watch it. That's my father you're talking about there. Or uncle, or stepfather, or the guy down the lane.
Now I see it, Sergeant, said Touchy. It's all right. I see it. That'd scar anyone for life.
The story ain't finished, Corporal. I ain't got to the whole point of it. You see, I was eating them damned spiders, eating them like candy. They said my belly was more swollen than my head, and that's why I was choking so bad. They were biting me all the way down. So they brought in the healer, and she conjured up big chunks of ice into my mouth, back of the throat, and all around my neck, too. Story goes that I had a stroke from all that ice. Killed the part of my brain that knows when it's time to stop.
She stared up at the brightening sky.
They say I stole my first jug from my father's stash when I was 6. Got so drunk they needed to bring the healer back a second time. And that's when she scried me inside and said I was in for a life of trouble.
A hand brushed her upper arm. That's a heartbreaking tale, Sergeant.
Is it? I suppose it is. Of course, I just made it up. Tug those heartstrings, see all that sweet sympathy in their sweet little faces. They'll forgive me anything now. Why do I hate spiders? God, who doesn't? What a stupid question.
Faces in the rock,
said Urgal the Woven, crouching to scrape patterns in the hard ground.
7 of the dying fires, the unbound. These are our titles. We T'lani Mas cast out from our clans. We who failed in the wars. We who were cursed to witness.
Nomkala shifted to look back upon the human camp, a dissolute column forming a jagged line across the hard pan. All motion was dying away there, the growing heat stealing all that was left. The humps of prostrate bodies stretched long shadows.
We chose a knight of chains, Uragal went on, and by his will we were freed from our prison. And by his will the chains shall one day shatter. Then we awaited the sanctification of the House of Chains.
This knight, rumbled Kaltur Manor, is he among us now?
No, but he awaits us, replied Uragal. Long has been his journey, and soon the fate of us all will fall at his feet. But alas, the Fallen One does not command him, and the King in Chains has turned his back on our cause. For the King of the House is cursed, and his chains will never break. It is our belief that he will not sit long upon that throne. Thus we discard him.
Baroque's soft voice said,
The knight is a despiser of chains, but understanding eludes him still. Many are the chains that cut cruel, that enslave with malice. Yet other chains also exist, and these are the ones we each choose to wear, not out of fear or ignorance. These are the noblest of chains. Honor, virtue, loyalty. Many will approach the House of Chains, only to falter upon its threshold, for it demands within us strength rarely used. When suffering awaits, it takes great courage to stride forward, to enter this unrelenting, unforgiving realm.
Uragal had scraped 7 symbols on the ground. He now pointed to each in turn and said,
The consort, she who is known to us, the Reaver, there are 2 faces, one man, one woman. Knight, we have spoken of. The 7 of the dead fires, the unbound. We Tlani Mas for now, but that will change. Cripple, he whose mind must crawl to serve the sacred life within him. Leper, that which is both living and dead. Fool, the threat from within. All, then, but the knight walk among the mortals in our keeping. Here, now.
Nomkala studied the symbols.
But Uragal, they are all dying.
And there is no wind to carry us,
Baruch said.
We cannot travel to what lies ahead. Thus we cannot give them hope.
Kaltur Manal grunted at Uragal's conclusion.
We are Tlani Mas. What know we of hope?
Are we then lost?
Nomkala asked. The others were silent.
I have a thought, she said. It is as Kalt says. We are not creatures of hope. We cannot give them what we surrendered so long ago. These mortal humans will die if we cannot save them. Do any of you dispute that?
We do not, said Uragal.
And so,
Nomkala stepped forward and with one skeletal foot broke the patterns in the dirt.
The House of Chains will die.
In another age it will awaken once more.
If it must be us, and we do wish it to be us, do we not? If it must be us unbound, then we have no choice. We must go to the adjunct.
And say what?
Uragal demanded.
Why, we must lie to her.
None spoke for a time. Nomkala studied the camp, the stretched shadows.
Let us seek to steal one more day.
To what end is one more day?
I cannot say, Uragal the Woven. Sometimes hope is born from a lie. So be it. To her we shall lie.
Ruthengard's eyes tracked Lostariel as she approached the adjunct. The two women stood studying the east as if to defy the savage dawn. He wondered what kept Tavare on her feet. Each night she set out, marching without rest, and by her will alone she dragged an entire army in her wake. If she would not stumble, then neither would the soldiers behind her. It had become a battle, a silent war.
And she's winning it. Everybody left behind is testament to that. But how much longer can she keep this up? Look at that rising sun, adjunct, and the emptiness beneath it. Sometimes, when people speak of forbidding, deadly places, it's not just a story. Sometimes it's all true, and the warnings are honest warnings. There are places that will kill you, and we have found one.
What are they saying, do you think?
Scannero asked. He looked down at her, eyes tightening.
Sleep, my love.
He watched her settle her head back on the hard ground, her eyes closing.
Not much longer. And now it's too late. I can't save you. I can't just steal you away because you won't make it.
He wondered if he would walk out of this desert alone. One survivor left, leaving behind 6,000 corpses. A damned Otateral sword in one hand for the day when he'd need it.
Aye, Ruthangud. He's been a one-man army before, after all. Here he goes again.
Lifting his gaze, he studied the two women standing 20 paces away and frowned.
Lostara, she's been possessed by a god. Does that make her tougher than she used to be? Who knows? But she's looking in better shape than Scannero. Better than the adjunct, too.
Please, lie beside me.
Ruthan flinched. He combed through his beard.
I will, in a moment.
Beloved?
A moment.
He walked over to Tavare in Lostara. If they were in a conversation, it wasn't one using words. The adjunct heard him approaching and turned to regard him.
Captain, the ice armor you conjured...
Not here, adjunct. Nothing works here.
Her eyes flattened.
But you will persevere.
Lostara Yil coughed and then said,
Ruthan, the Tlanimas bow to you. They title you Elder.
I am not a god, Elder or otherwise, Lostara. I'm sorry. Wouldn't it be nice to be one, though, for each and every one of us, just to be outside all this? The Tlanimas will manage when...
So will you,
the adjunct cut in.
Yet you are not a god?
We do not choose to whom we are born.
Indeed not. Who, then, are your parents?
He scratched his beard vigorously.
Adjunct, does it matter? It may be that this desert doesn't kill me. It's equally likely that it will.
You will reach the city with the wells.
Will I?
Ruthan shook his head.
Let me be honest with you. I cannot fathom how those children got as far as they did. What did Badal say? 10 days away? But Icarius is 2, even 3 weeks march from here.
How do you know this?
He grimaced.
I was once a guest of the Jaghut who dwelt in Icarius along with the refugee enclave of Kachin Chimal. The simple fact remains, the only way those children could have come as far as they have, adjunct, is by Warren.
Tavare turned to Lostara.
Get the girl. Bring her to me.
Aye, adjunct.
When she'd departed, Tavare fixed Ruthan with a hard stare.
A warren.
Which is impossible, I know.
He saw a glitter of hope in her eyes and shook his head.
Do not, adjunct. The desert is sucked dry, and if you're not careful, things are likely to get much worse.
Worse? Explain to me how this could get worse, captain.
He looked away, back to where Scannero slept, and sighed.
Draw your sword, adjunct.
What?
Unsheathe your Otateral blade.
She had the sword half out of the scabbard before Ruthan reached out and grasped her wrist. And then, retching, he fell to his knees, turning his head away. Tavare slammed the weapon back down and staggered back a step.
Gods!
She gasped. Ruthan spat and then used the back of his wrist to wipe at his beard.
It's what none of you ever understood,
he said, staring down at his trembling hands. studying the smears of blood in what he'd coughed up.
It's not just some damned metal that just happens to devour magic. Otataral is aspected.
He pushed himself back onto his feet.
The next time you draw that weapon, adjunct, the act will summon. She is loose upon the world now, the dragon that is the source of all Otataral, the living heart of that which takes life. She has been freed.
Tavray took another step back, shaking her head.
What has been done?
She demanded, her voice breaking. He saw panic rising within her, vast cracks in her armor, and held out a hand.
Wait, listen to me. Tavray Paran, listen! It will be answered. Everything is answered. Everything!
And now, all at once, it was as if a child was standing before him, lost, frightened. The sight tore at his heart.
They're not interested in the crippled god. Do you understand me? The ones who did this, they don't care what happens to him. They're reaching for something bigger, and they think they will sweep all this aside. You, the fallen one, the Fokrel assailed, all of it swept away. But they're fools. Do you understand me? Anomander Rake is gone, but Draconis now walks the world. Do you see? Everything is answered. And that is the true madness of this. The Otataral dragon cannot remain unchained. Draconis will have to kill it, him or the Elaint. And by killing it, they will end all magic. They will cast us all out into a world devoid of sorcery.
She had turned away from him, was now staring into the east.
This is what he meant, she murmured.
Adjunct?
He said my sword would not be enough. We argued that again and again. He said...
She faced him, eyes suddenly shining, and Ruthan was struck by a sudden beauty in her face, a thing that seemed to rise as if from nowhere.
He said, it will be answered. His words, the same as yours.
Who are you talking about? He demanded. Who's been scheming this nightmare all along? What raving lunatic idiot?
Ben Edifon Delat.
He stared, disbelieving, thunderstruck at his own stupidity.
That name!
High Mage Quick Ben, Captain. He vowed he would save Bern, and that was one vow he would not surrender. He said the cancer needed cutting out. Ruthan, what is wrong?
But he had turned away, struggling to hold it all in, struggling and then failing. Laughter burst from him, disbelieving, wondrous laughter.
Delat? Edifon Delat? Quick Ben? Oh, by the abyss, the bloody nerve of him! Was it a glamour that made me so sick? No wonder he stayed away from me.
Captain?
He stared at her, and he could feel his mouth stretched wide in a manic, helpless grin.
And down he went in the battle with the Shorttails, like Hood he did.
Her lips thinned into a straight line. Captain Ruthan Gud, even you could not be so dense.
Of course he isn't dead.
She pointed to a nearby figure perched atop an outcrop of rock.
Ask our resident Septarch of Derek. He will tell you, since he at last has figured it out.
As if commanded, Banaskar rose then, tottering as he walked to them. He wagged a finger at Ruthan Gud, and through cracked, bleeding lips he said,
This is Quick Ben's game, O Elder. The bones are in his sweaty hands, and they have been for some time. Now if at his table you'll find the Worm of Autumn, and the once Lord of Death, and Shadow Throne, and Cotillion, not to mention the past players Anomander Rake and Decembre, and who knows who else? Well, did you really believe a few thousand damned Naruk could take him down? The thing about Edifon Delat's game is this. He cheats.
He turned to the adjunct and managed a faint bow.
Lady Tavore, it is fair to say that I will remember the light in your eyes, as I am privileged to see it now, for the rest of my days. Did I not speak of heroism?
I believe I did, though in your despond perhaps you were not listening.
By your words, High Priest, I found the strength for the next step. Forgive me if I could give you nothing in return.
He cocked his head and regarded her, and then said softly,
My lady, have you not given enough?
Ruthengard clawed at his beard. The delight was fast fading, and he feared stirring the ashes and finding that hope had been nothing but a lone spark already gone.
We still face a dilemma, and oh, how I wish Delat was here, though I think even he would have no answers for our plight. This desert will have us.
Tavare said, Captain, if I fall, take up my sword.
If I do, adjunct, and if indeed a time comes when I must draw that weapon, it will kill me.
Then as you have said, you must not be an elder god.
As I said, he agreed wryly. But the matter is simpler than that. I have lived a long time, and that is by magic alone. Without sorcery, I would be less than dust.
He glanced at Banaskar.
Delat is not the only one to have gamed at the table of the gods. I would know your story someday, Ruthengard, said Banaskar with a sad smile.
Ruthengard shrugged.
To be honest, too sordid to tell.
They were silent, as if so thoroughly wrung out by all that had been said and felt that nothing remained. Lostara then returned, and at her side was the girl named Badal, and a boy carrying a sack. Nomkala walked through a silent camp, bodies lying motionless on all sides, half-closed eyes tracking her as she strode past. She saw suffering on a scale that made long-dead emotions tremble inside her, and she remembered the fate of her own kind when walls of ice closed in, when the animals died out or went away, when there was nothing left to eat, when the humans hunted them down. Their answer had been the ritual, an escape that proved a prison. But such a thing was not available to these mortals.
Another day. A lie to give them that, if one is even possible. See how weak they are. See how they fail. Another day. But would that be a gift? The marching, the dragging steps, the ones falling to the side to surrender? Will they thank me for those extra moments?
Perhaps her desire to help was in fact one of cruelty.
So, how does it feel?
At the faint voice she halted, looked round, saw a soldier sitting nearby, studying her.
How does what feel? She asked.
Being dust.
She did not know how to answer him, and so was silent.
We'll be joining you soon enough, I suppose.
No, you won't. No memory will remain, nothing to draw you back.
But I have strings, Tlani Mas. That's my private curse. I will be pulled back together, or they'll try anyway, over and over again.
Nomkala studied the man and then shook her head.
I see no strings, mortal. If they once existed, now they are gone. Nothing holds you, not the will of gods, not the lies of destiny or fate. You are severed from everything but that which lives within you.
Truly? No wonder I feel so lonely.
Yes, she said, that is the reason.
But you are not alone, are you, Tlani Mas?
No, but that is no salvation. Together we but share our loneliness.
He snorted.
Not sure that makes sense, but I think I understand you anyway.
Listen, do us a favor.
Once the last of us has fallen, don't fall to dust. Don't give up just yet. Walk out of this desert. Walk out of it. Please, will you do that?
Because it is said that this desert cannot be crossed. Yes, I understand you, mortal.
Will you do it?
We shall.
He settled back on his bedroll with an uneven sigh.
Good. Prove them wrong. It's good enough, I think.
Namkala hesitated and then said, "Do not give up, soldier. One more march." Eyes closed, he asked, "What would be the point of that?" "Push your comrades on through this next night. Do this, please. As I have agreed to do as you wish, I ask that you reciprocate."
He opened his eyes, squinted at her.
"Is it that important?"
"Suffering is a chasm. But there is the other side, and upon that side waits the fallen god. I am one of the seven now. I am one among the unbound. The fallen one understands suffering, mortal. In that you are not alone. In that neither are the Tlanimas alone."
"Aye, I'll grant you that he knows a thing or two about suffering. That you do as well. I just don't see the comfort in that kind of sharing."
"If not comfort, then find strength."
"To keep bearing that suffering? What for?"
"Yes, Namkala, what for? Do you have an answer? Does anyone?"
"When you at last reach across that chasm, mortal, and grasp tight the hand of the fallen one, ask him your question."
He managed a sour smile.
"Convenient," and he closed his eyes once more.
She continued on, troubled, heavy with anguish.
"The Tlanimas have seen civilizations rise and fall. We have seen lands die only to be reborn. We have seen the seas rise and we have walked ancient seabeds. We have witnessed life's myriad struggles, from the lone creature suffering its last moments to thousands dying in a bleak season. And what have we learned? Only that life is its own purpose, and that where there is life, there shall be suffering. Has it any meaning? Is existence reason enough? I am an unbound. I am free to see, and what is it that I see? I see nothing."
Ahead, at the vanguard of the column, there were figures standing.
"Now I must find a worthy lie. And if my name is to be cursed in the last breaths of these humans, so be it. My crime was hope. My punishment is to see it fail. But the Tlanimas have weathered that punishment for a long time, and the failure of hope has a name. It is called suffering."
"Words," said Badal, meeting the adjunct's eyes. "I found power in words, but that power is gone. I have nothing left."
Mother turned to her companions, but said nothing. There was almost no life left in her plain face, her plain eyes, and seeing that hurt Badal somewhere inside.
"I had a poem for you, but it is gone, dried up."
A man combed his beard with filthy fingers and said,
"Child, if your strength returns, another day."
"It is not that kind of strength,"
Badal replied.
"It is gone, perhaps forever. I do not know how to get it back. I think it has died." "I am not your hope. I cannot be. It was meant to be the other way round, don't you see that? We are children, that and nothing more. The god that died here, it was the same."
Mother frowned. "Can you explain that, Badal?" She shook her head. The other man, the one with the haunted eyes, then spoke.
"What can you tell us of that god, Badal?"
"He broke apart."
"Did he just break apart, or did someone break him apart?"
"He was murdered by his followers."
The man reacted as if he'd been struck in the face.
"It is in the Song of the Shards," she continued. "The gods sought to give his people one last gift, but they refused it. They would not live by it, and so they killed him."
She shrugged.
"It was long ago, in the age when believers murdered their gods if they didn't like what the god had to say. But it's all different now, isn't it?"
"Aye," the bearded man muttered.
Now we just ignore them to death.
It's not the gods that we ignore, said the woman standing beside Mother. Just their gifts of wisdom.
The other man spoke.
Do that long enough and the gods just wither and die. So it takes longer, but in the end, it's still murder. And we're just as vicious with mortals who have the nerve to say things we don't want to hear.
He cursed and then said,
Is it any wonder we've outstayed our welcome?
Mother met Badal's eyes and asked,
This city, Icarius, who dwells there? Only ghosts, Mother.
Beside her, Sadik had seated himself on the ground, taking out his useless things, but at the mention of Icarius he looked up and then pointed at the bearded man.
Badal,
he said,
I saw this man in the crystal caves beneath the city.
She considered this and then shrugged.
Not ghosts, then. Memories.
Forever frozen, the bearded man said, eyeing the boy.
He faced Mother.
Adjunct, they cannot help you. Look at them. They're dying just as we are. Would that we could have done better by them, said the other man.
Mother hesitated and then nodded as if in defeat.
This is not how it should be. What am I not seeing? Why do I feel so helpless?
The bearded man was still watching Sadik, and then he said,
Send them back to their beds, adjunct. This is all too cruel, the sun and heat, I mean.
Lastara?
No, I will escort them, adjunct.
Very well, captain.
Badal, this man, Ruthungad, will take you back now.
Yes, mother.
The captain settled into a crouch, facing Sadik.
Here, he said gruffly. Let me help with these toys.
Badal stared, suddenly breathless, watching as Ruthungad and Sadik filled the tattered bag. Something made Sadik look up then, his eyes meeting hers.
Badal, what is it? What did he say?
She struggled to breathe, struggled to speak. Something fierce and wild rushed through her. She fell to her knees, snatched the bag from Sadik's small hands. She spilled the objects back out and stared down at them in wonder.
Badal?
The captain had leaned back, startled by the vehemence in her gesture, yet he said nothing.
Badal? Sadik, these things, they're toys.
He looked up at her, the color leaving his face, showing her, bared and raw, wretched astonishment. Then that shattered, and she could see that he was about to cry.
I'm sorry, I'd forgotten.
She watched as Sadik's attention returned to the collection of objects spilled out on the ground before him. He reached out as if to touch one, a bundle of twine and feathers, and then snatched back his hand.
Toys,
he whispered.
They're toys.
The captain climbed to his feet and backed away. His dark eyes met her gaze, and she saw the horror in them, and she understood.
Yes, this is what we lost. Thank you, Captain,
she said quietly.
We will go back, just not yet. Please?
He nodded, and then led the other adults away. And though it was obvious that they were confused, that they had questions, not one of them said a word. Badal moved to kneel across from Sadik. She stared down at the array, weakened by a sudden feeling of helplessness.
I don't remember.
Yet, when she reached down to pick up the pommel from a knife or sword, when she hesitated and looked over at Sadik, he simply nodded his invitation. 30 paces away, hot but dry-skinned in the burgeoning heat, Ruthungad stood watching, his only company the adjunct. In a few terse, difficult words, he had explained his sense of what had just happened. Neither spoke for some time. It wasn't fair. Of all the crimes he had seen in a life almost too long to comprehend,
this one surpasses them all. The look on her face, on the boy's when she told him, that pathetic collection carried like a treasure, and is it not a treasure?
Finally, he wiped a hand before his eyes and said,
We spoke of murdering gods with a strange diffidence, almost a bluster. And what did they show us? Adjunct, what are we when we murder innocents?
Tavare's sigh was ragged.
It will be answered.
He saw her take on the burden, in the settling of her shoulders, recognized the breathtaking courage in the way she lifted her head, the way she refused to look away from the scene.
Of two children trying to remember what it is to play. Adjunct, do not do this. You cannot carry anything more.
Hearing someone behind them, they both turned. At Tlani Mas, Ruthengard grunted,
one of our deserters.
Namkala, the apparition replied. Now in the service of the Fallen One, Elder.
What do you wish to tell me? Tavare asked.
Adjunct, you must march for another night. You cannot stop here. You cannot give up. One more night.
I intend to march for as many nights as we can, Namkala.
She was silent, as if nonplussed. Ruthengard cleared his throat.
You don't want us to give up. We understand that, Namkala. We are the Fallen One's last hope.
Your soldiers fail.
They're not interested in worshipping the crippled god, he said. They don't want to give their lives to a cause they don't understand. This confusion and reluctance weakens their spirit.
Yes, Elder. Thus, there must be one more night of marching.
And then, the adjunct demanded, what salvation will find us by tomorrow's dawn?
The seven of the dying fires shall endeavor to awaken Telan, Namkala replied. We have begun our preparations for a ritual of opening. Once we have created a gate, we shall travel through to a place where there is fresh water. We shall fill the casks once more and return to you. But we need another day.
There are but seven of you, Ruthen said. In this desert, that is not enough.
We shall succeed in this, Elder.
Ruthen cocked his head.
If you say so.
I do. Now, please inform your soldiers. One more march.
To reach salvation, said the adjunct.
Yes.
Very well, Namkala.
The Tlani Mas bowed to them both, turned and then strode back into the camp. When she was gone, the adjunct sighed.
In your obviously long life, Captain, did you ever throw dice with a Tlani Mas?
No, and I used to think that wisdom on my part.
And now?
Ruthengard shook his head.
They are terrible liars.
Still, she said under her breath, I appreciate the effort.
We don't need it, adjunct. To keep us all going, we don't need it.
We don't?
No. And he pointed to Badal and Sadik. I will go among the troops this day, adjunct, for I have a story to tell. Two children, a sack of toys.
She eyed him.
These children?
He nodded.
These children.